Hey, Outlaw Nation fans, and welcome to another episode of The Deep Cut here on the Outlaw Nation. I'm incredibly excited to welcome a director, producer, writer, storyboard artist, and sometime actor here in the world of animation. He has a new film that he is dropping now on VOD from Warner Brothers. It is called Scoob! I'm so excited to talk to this gentleman. That is Tony Cervone. You've seen his work. I hope I'm saying that right. He'll correct me when he comes on. But you've seen his work in Animaniacs, Duck Dodgers, Pinky and the Brain, the Tom and Jerry Tales, the Looney Tunes show that came out in 2011. He was the director of animation for Space Jam, which we're going to talk about, considering The Last Dance is happening all over the place now. And of course, he's the director now of this new film, as I mentioned, Scoob, which is an updated approach to a classic Hanna-Barbera cartoon that is amongst one of my favorites. And I'm sure for most of you all, it's one of your favorites, Scooby-Doo and the Mr. Machine Gang. Let's bring him on now. Tony Cervone, how are you, man? Am I saying the last name right? How are you?
It's Cervone, but that's Cervone. I will also answer to Cervone. But
okay, Cervone is totally fine. How are you, man? How you doing? You're in your bunker yourself. You got the playoff beard going on. Talk to me.
Yeah, that's right. I'm good. I'm excited and nervous and all those things because the big movie comes out, be available tomorrow and forever.
Yeah. Know?
So, well, it's coming.
By the time this comes out, it'll already be available.
Oh, okay.
So, because we're dropping this on Monday, according to what I was told from Warner Brothers. My question to you right off the bat, you've done so many things. You've had a storied history and career. I mean, going back to Animaniacs when it first was up with Steven Spielberg, and you've worked on so many projects. Would you say that this is your biggest project that you've ever undertaken? It took 6 years. You're adapting or updating a classic cartoon like this that people get really touchy about. Like, is this your biggest project? My first question.
Yeah, I would say this is it. I mean, I think I've been lucky enough to be on some big things, mm-hmm. but this is really important. You know, this is the first all animated Scooby-Doo movie, and it was quite a challenge, but a great challenge and a lot of fun.
When you were starting the process, did you lobby to become the director on this? How did you come to be the director on this project?
I didn't. There was a script that by Matt Lieberman and Chris DeFari at the time asked my wife Allison Abadi and I to read the script, and I had already done some Scooby-Doo stuff by that point.
Right.
But both of us really liked it. So we joined the movie as director and producer. Mm-hmm. And then she's gone on to actually running the Warner Brothers feature animation WAG unit. So she's, but also a producer. So she wound up even busier than I was. but what I really loved about the script and loved about this story was, even though it's a Hanna-Barbera universe, it was really centering on Scooby and Shaggy and their friendship and their relationship, and took these two characters that are usually like the comic relief in their show and move them into the spotlight. Like it is their a big movie with a lot of characters, but they're really the stars. This is really their story.
Yeah, and it's such a great point you bring up here, because I watched the movie this morning, you know, as I used to watch Scooby-Doo cartoons in the morning before school, having my cereal. I literally went back in time to watch this because I wanted to be in the right mood to appreciate it. And I had a bit of skepticism initially because I'm like, well, is this going to work? Is it going to be cheesy? Are they going to go for the easy jokes? Or is this actually going to be a unique update that is artistic and, for lack of a better term. And as I was watching it, I found myself just having a big, stupid grin on my face and appreciating the work, appreciating the music choices, the look of it, the animation, the direction, and yes, the heart of these two characters who have usually been kind of dismissed or played for comedy relief. But to see them, see their beginning, and then see their connection and their heart. I mean, I think that was really the number one thing as I was watching it, was enjoying the connection between Scooby and Shaggy.
I mean, as as much as we love the jokes and the action and the mystery and the scale and scope of this movie, the thing really honestly we sweated the most was these two guys.
Yeah.
You know, Scooby and Shaggy, their friendship, their relationship. The audience already loves them. Our goal was to make you love them even more by the end of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like we go deeper with them emotionally than anyone expects. And I don't know. I love them, you know?
Well, it's a very real story of like, well, what happens when one person, and I don't want to give away too much, obviously, because we want people to enjoy it and download it, but what happens when one person kind of goes farther than the other person? How does that affect the friendship?
I mean,
you talk about this, your wife being a producer, now she jumped onto the, like, you know, it's that kind of thing.
I know, like, I feel a little like Shaggy right now. but I do think it's an important story for everyone, for kids and their parents. Like, friendship endures. How does it endure, right? You know, because life is full of changes. You're a little kid, you have your best friend, you wind up in two different classes, or you wind up in two different schools, or one moves, and then later one moves away, or someone gets married, or then their families, everything, jobs pull you in different directions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've had friends I made when I was 5 years old, and we don't live in this, you know, and also like that distance, and right now, right now there's a bunch of people separated from their friends. Like we're physically separated from each other. And kids aren't used to this. And what does that mean? What does that mean to friendship? What is friendship based on? And I think this movie has something to say about it. So I think it's timely.
Absolutely. I do think it's timely as well. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if families download this and their kids immediately call their friends or even the parents, because there's a lot here for parents and adults to enjoy, because yes, we can all act like we're mature, we've grown up, but cartoons, animated series, they have a way of touching us, you know, and ripping through all that and getting to our inner child, because a lot of us grew up watching these things, and they're our first lessons about life. And about friendship is from these cartoons.
Absolutely. That's one of the animation strong points is like, it goes right in, right? It goes right to your heart. And for comedy and for character, like everyone has their characters they grew up with. And to them, they're more than things on a screen. They're friends. And we have to be respectful to that.
Yeah. You only spend a few amount. I think you spend enough time in the prequel area of this relationship. Was that the most important area of the movie that you all wanted to focus on to get that right? Because everything stems from that relationship.
Right. Yeah. That meeting, that first meet, you know, we get to see the moment when Scooby met Shaggy, what was going on and what was at stake. And I think that was that's a scene we worked on many, many times and tried different iterations of. And and also it was important to me that the movie has a real sense of place. So it felt kind of real. And I grew up outside of Chicago, but I always felt that Scooby-Doo took place in Southern California. And I'm like, we're going to be here. I want to feel like I could walk down that boardwalk or down that street. I wanted it to feel real, but in a stylized cartoon way.
Right. And listen, the Scooby-Doo series, you know, is an interesting series because it originated in 1969. And you've talked about some other interviews with the Robert Kennedy assassination influencing these cartoons to be a little more friendly, a little more fun, a little more playful. But you do have a combo of what is supposed to be the head cheerleader, the head quarterback, the nerd, and then you have the stoner, the dropout, with Shaggy. And then you, of course, have Scooby. So it's so funny to see this thing being updated to now, where it's actually Shaggy who's the cool one, and everyone else is kind of a little bit different now. It's so funny to see the change. It doesn't mean them less cool.
No, it's like that. Remember the movie 21 Jump Street, right?
Oh yeah,
how that flipped who was cool in the past and who's cool now, like
with the two backpack straps,
the single strap,
right?
It's a little bit like that, but I think these characters are still relevant because like the Breakfast Club. We still got the nerd and the jock and the and the pretty girl and the wastoid, you know.
Right.
So
right.
It's still relevant. There's still, that's one of the reasons I think we still love them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the update, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed this thing. Just absolutely enjoyed it. I love the update because, I mean, you can update this thing and take the easy way out, right? You can comment on the characters in a kind of smirky, snarky way, which I've seen other animated things do when they try to update, but yours doesn't do that. There's a lot of love for these characters throughout the movie. And I think that helps us, even when you adjust them a little bit, like Fred being in love with the van, you know, Daphne with what she's doing with the, I mean, just from the beginning, when we see them as kids, you're laying the groundwork. That's a Wonder Woman. Yeah. That's topical.
Yeah.
That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That's topical. Like all of it just works.
And that's
really
the knight in shining armor.
Yeah, knight in shining armor.
Fred thinks he is, you know, like, no, for sure. I mean, we try to do both things. We try to honor the past and try to honor the expectations of the fan. Cause if you don't give them what they want and what they paid for,
right,
that's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. But also we have to do something new, or we got to do both at the same time and not at the expense of the other, you know?
Right.
And I think we did a pretty good job with that in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that completely. When you look at the movie too, what struck me also is like, this is actually a layered story. This isn't a simple villain twirling them. There's more involved here than you would think. There's some educational stuff to discover about ancient Egypt. Like, there's a lot thrown in here that I thought, you know, and Scooby-Doo in the past subtly throws these things in there every once in a while in these episodes. So I love that you honored that by making that a really integral part of the plot.
Yeah, we actually talked to scholars, ancient Greece scholars, just to get things right. Like, there's some prophecies and things that are, you know, and make sure that they were written correctly in the way they would have actually been. I mean, I think our Acropolis looks a little bit more like Las Vegas than probably it really did, but that's okay. It's a movie.
It's timely. Right.
But everything is colorful and fun. Like,
yeah,
it's Scooby-Doo. There's some scares. There's some things in there, you know, like but nothing I think is going to, it's always done in fun and done in a colorful, cool way.
Yeah. And you've got an incredible cast here, because we'll swing back to another thing I want to talk about. We should definitely mention the cast here. Will Forte is the voice of Shaggy. Zac Efron, the voice of Fred. Gina Rodriguez, you know, as a Latino, I'm incredibly happy to see her in this as Velma. Amanda Seyfried is Daphne. And then Frank Welker, of course, reprising the role of Scooby, which he's done for the last two or three decades now. Incredible stuff. And you have Jason Isaacs involved in this. You've got Simon Cowell making an appearance. You've got a number of people involved in this. What was it like were you there in the sessions working? I've done voiceover before. Sometimes the director is there. Sometimes it's a animation director who's there, or a voice director who's there. Were you there for every one of these sessions with these actors to find their performance?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was there with the actors on every session and really worked with them, because, you know, we wanted to make sure this is a different universe. I feel like this is a Hanna-Barbera cinematic universe, and it's different. It's different than the normal Scooby-Doo universe. And we knew we were going to change the cast, and we did it for that reason. We wanted this to be its own thing. But we didn't want anyone to just kind of mimic the past. I mean, we have a great leg up because we have Frank Welker.
Of course.
Right? He is the cornerstone. He is the anchor. He is the house upon which Scooby-Doo is built right now. So that, I think, gave us some liberty a little bit of going, okay, we know Fred is, but Zach, you're an amazing, talented guy. How do you want to bend this a little bit? How do you want to bring Zach into it? And, you know, same thing, absolutely the same thing with Will. Like, Will has more lines than anybody. It really is. Shaggy does the heavy lifting, you know, so how much of that is, you know, there's hints of all the Shaggies in there, but really it's Will and it's Will's heart and it's Will's emotion that I think elevates that character in this movie, this version of Shaggy, you know?
Yeah. It's incredible to see how many of these SNL alums have come out and like really established themselves. Because I remember in the past, that rarely ever happened, you know, for the most part. But now you've got entire casts that are still working and coming out and doing. I mean, like, Bill, we just ripped through Bill Hader in Barry, rewatched the entire two seasons. And Forte with Last Man on Earth and all the stuff that he's done. It's incredible to see his work here as a voiceover artist. And then, as if that isn't enough, you throw in Mark Wahlberg. This is its first voiceover job.
And I couldn't believe that, like, because he is such a natural that even I didn't know that until we met. And then he's yeah, I've never done this before. And I was like, really? And he's like, nope. And then I started thinking and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. I was shocked because he has such a great voice to animate to and such a great delivery and such great timing and all of the characters, because we don't just do this in a weekend, you know, it takes like a year or two to record these voices. Mm-hmm. And in that time, there is still some growing and changing going on. So absolutely, once the cast was in place, we started kind of writing and crafting the characters to them in a good way. But definitely Brian came to life when Mark got involved.
Yeah, right. I mean, I really enjoy his performance. And you know what's great is Falcon was always, is it Blue Falcon, right? Blue Falcon was always like supposed to be a Batman spinoff or knockoff. But you really, in the design of you really make it clear with the black mask and the black cape. And I'm okay, they're letting you know for real. Yeah. They understand the history of this character, which I appreciate.
We have the original Blue Falcon kind of in the movie.
Yes.
Like we still have, you know, that character's represented, but we wanted to kind of change the costume and come up with a slightly, you know, a kind of a different, more movie kind of superhero costume that felt like it came from a movie. And so it was cool doing that. And yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of Bruce Timm in that character, you know, we looked at a lot of the old Fleischer Superman cartoons, like from the 40s.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of that physicality, you know, those are the things we looked at. We really, there's a lot of different animation styles in this movie. Like, we very purposefully went, they're almost all coming from different universes.
Yeah.
Sometimes all happening in the same shot.
Right.
So it is feel a little like you've got a Bruce Timm Batman standing next to a cartoony, these two cartoon characters with next to a more realistic character. Like, it's all over the place, but hopefully in an entertaining way.
Oh, it is very much so. And it, you know, it's subtle, and I don't know if this is intended. It makes sense, right? Because once again, we don't want to go too much, but there's a journey that Mark Wahlberg's character is going on, an emotional journey here that's related to the family. And of course, he would try to go in one direction, be a little bit more overt in the design of the costume than someone else needed to be when they were doing both. So I thought that's exactly what someone like that in that situation would do. And I enjoy that you give him an emotional journey to go through as well. So, you know, I love that.
Yeah. We have three characters that are like the human dog relationships. Dynamite and Blue Falcon, Scooby, Shaggy, and Dastardly and Muttley. And what is that? How do they all contrast each other? And how do they all sometimes mirror each other?
Like,
someone said that those three couples are like the history of a relationship. Like, like Scooby and Shaggy are in the honeymoon stage. They just don't ever want to be apart. Dynamite and Blue Falcon are maintaining. They get on each other's nerves, but they're trying to keep the train on the tracks.
There's still love there, yeah.
Right, yeah. And Dastardly and Muttley are at like the end stage of a relationship where they're sniping at each other and arguing.
That's the Costanzas. That's right, the Costanzas, right?
But still very much in a relationship, right? Like, you can't tell them. They're still in it together. So, So that's kind of the way we thought about it a little bit.
With when did Michael Kurinsky, who of course did Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse as a production designer, when did he step into the fold here? Because I couldn't help but feel that way. And this was before I knew Kurinsky was involved. When I was watching it this morning, I was like, oh, this feels like Spider-Verse. Like you've got all these different characters roaming through from the Hanna-Barbera universe. It has shades of it. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. It was this on purpose. And then when I did research for the interview, Kurinsky was involved. I was so surprised by this. How early on in the process was he involved? And how much did he shape it?
3 years. Like, for the whole this movie, this version of the movie, Kurinsky was involved for the whole time. And we had an earlier art department for a different version. And some of those designs, a lot of awesome things continued, but we pulled them into this look. But yeah, it's definitely, everything's on purpose. Like I said, we want, like Spider-Verse did such a great job of showing this stylized version of New York.
Yeah.
That I felt like I could go there. And, and we were like, no, we want the Southern California version of that, like super idealized, the LA that exists in your imagination. Right. That might not be the real Venice Beach, but
first note I made on my phone as I was watching was, I'd love to live in this Venice Beach.
I don't know what parents let their 10-year-old boy wander Venice Beach by himself, but it's a movie.
It's right. and that's the other thing that's interesting about the movie is it feels not in a time. It just feels whenever you're watching it, it's existing, right? Because in the 80s, of course a kid could wander Venice by himself in the 60s and 70s. No problem. Nowadays, people go insane. But it feels, but again, it's an animated movie, so you give it that license, but it never feels like it's taking place at a certain time, which I think is kind of the charm of the movie. You could watch it in 20 years and still enjoy that it feels current.
Wow, that's great. I hope so. There's something kind of like, those are kind of modern versions of their costumes. But if something didn't need to change, we didn't change it. We actually had Jamie Mizrahi, who's a great stylist, come in and help us with the costumes. Because we were like, what would these, if you're 20 years old, what would you be wearing now? And she's like, an orange turtleneck sweater. And I'm like, all right.
Dial it up.
but also like some of those changes, even though they might be subtle, they're very feel right. So she was awesome and super helpful.
Yeah. How worried were you about some of the jokes that were softball shots at the original series? Were there other jokes that were cut out? You're like, no, it's a little too nasty, a little too snarky. Like, because there are a couple of jokes you make at the original series, which I think are sweet and very modern.
Yeah, I don't think we make fun of. We had some jokes that we actually cut that were just too like racy, for a family audience. But we might be a little self-aware, but I think it's clear how much we love this source material. Hopefully we didn't cross the snark line too much.
It feels organic and fun. And when you watch the Lego Star Wars ones, I don't know if anybody's watched those Lego Star Wars ones are brilliant because they're making fun of what they're talking about, but they're doing it in a place of ultimate respect.
Yeah.
And so you're in on the joke, which is fun and it's inclusive.
That's Mel Brooks's, the Mel Brooks law of parody is, and he said that, I must have been like 10 years old when I heard this, but it stuck with me, which is you need to love something to parody it.
Right.
Like he's like, I love Westerns, so I made Blazing Saddles. I love Frankenstein, so I made Young. I can only parody the things I love. And I'm like, that's a way to look at it. Because otherwise I think you just get mean-spirited, you know? Right. But if you love it, you can make fun of it and still be comfortable about it.
Right. It almost feels like a friend would do. A friend who always knows, how to get you in the right place and still be okay.
And like Friends, that's something we try to work joke-wise in with the gang, right? The way the gang kind of interrupts each other or teases each other. Like, they're friends, and that's how friends talk. They talk over each other a little bit. They make fun of each other a little bit. They get frustrated. They hug each other and love each other. So. Yeah. We try to do all those, we try to make it feel like real people.
Yeah. And certainly that comes across the vibrancy of the animation. I have to talk about that. It is such a vibrant film. Look, and I've seen, animated series. My friend, Michael Vogel, he's done stuff for My Little Pony. So he'll like send me series I need to watch to see what's happening in animation. And sometimes I'll watch those and I'll feel like, oh, it feels like the characters are existing outside of the world they're being animated in. But that did not happen in this film. Sometimes it can be really vibrant and bright. The computer generated images, all that stuff is good to watch, but it's only good to watch if it feels seamless and organic. And I think you all absolutely nailed that in this movie. It feels very like lived in, yet new and vibrant. How did that come about as a look? Like, who made that decision?
Well, that's, you know, our Chris Fowler is our lighting, and Jeff, all our the gang at Real Effects who animated the movie, they're all awesome, and you know, everyone was really working at the top of their game, and a lot of that is Kerensky. But a lot of that too is from a very early stage. I was like, this, I want this to be extremely colorful. I love color. Like, if you, the Mystery Incorporated is a very colorful show. The even the Looney Tunes show is a very colorful show. But there was something where I love vivid color in kind of horror, like the combination of vivid color and horror, you know what I mean? Like, kind of when I was growing up, I had all those monster magazines, you know, the famous monster.
Yeah, Fangoria magazine. And all that stuff.
And all those painted covers that, you know, Basil Gogos did. And I loved Frank Frazetta growing up, and all the covers of all those books, the Conan books. They were, they're so brightly colored. And there used to be these model kits, the Aurora model kits, that all their covers were just bright, psychedelic colors. So we were like, I want that to feel like that. I want like the almost psychedelic to the point, you know, so colorful. It's we've left reality behind. There's a Hall of Mirrors sequence in the movie that to get those colors, we couldn't do it with light.
Right.
So without giving, you know, like it's so colorful, we had to actually just make colored versions of the characters.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what I mean? Like we couldn't make Scooby-Doo that blue just by putting him with blue light. So we were just like, I guess we got to just make a blue Scooby-Doo. So like there's all multicolored characters. It's so, it gets trippy, trippy in a fun way.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you distinct when you were like, how much time did you all spend on getting the script right, getting the lines right? Because like you said, there's three different relationships in this movie. And when those emotional beats pop up in the journey of all three of those relationships, it's important to like note what's happening. Like you're keeping track of what's happening with all of them. How important was it for you to keep track of that and not get lost in like the other stuff that get the plot points that drives you to the next plot point? It drives you to the next plot point.
It's crazy important. And we worked 5 years on it. Like that type of work never stops, especially in animation where it's like, I just, you know, you come in like that. Like I said, we record these. It takes years to record these things.
Yeah.
No, we kept working on that, and the balance of it. Like we have a lot of characters in a complicated movie. But it's about Scooby and Shaggy. So if the balance started feeling off, you know, at one point we had more Hanna-Barbera characters in the movie.
Oh, that was going to be my next question, but yes, please.
There were more, but we just, as we kept going and as we kept fine tuning and sculpting, it was like they started distracting from our main characters.
Right.
And so some characters got benched. They make an appearance in the end credits, but at one point they were active in the movie.
Yeah, I got a bone to pick with you because you left out Grape Ape. You left out Grape Ape.
That's my long boy. I know. We had a really cool Grape Ape too. We
that
built
was
those.
My boy, man.
We have those characters. Like those characters were built. They're ready to go.
So, oh wow!
Yeah, okay. We had a really cool Grape Ape too.
Oh, so maybe in a
Jabberjaw Grape Ape and Adamant were great.
Yeah. Adamant, that's right. Did you get Adamant as well? That's right. Here's the credits. And Speed Buggy, I read somewhere you were looking at that.
We talked about Speed Buggy at one point about being that the Falcon Fury, Blue Falcon's ship, was intelligent. And so we talked about maybe Speed Buggy, that voice would be the voice of the ship. As if he had bought Speed Buggy at some point and put his brain inside the Falcon Fury.
I like that idea.
We have a lot of theories. We got, you know, we go in real deep. So
that's for the commentary track. That's for the commentary track, yeah. I imagine. Something else I read doing research for this interview with you, Tony, was that this that the opening sequence, the original Scooby-Doo animation opening sequence that you put in here when the the movie transitions into the older ages, which was such a great surprise. I mean, I was afraid that you all weren't going to touch that, leave that alone, because you didn't want people to compare. But you animated this, that this was late in the process. Yeah. Did you feel there was something missing, and so you guys were racking your brains about it? Okay.
Well, we had worked on that sequence, that sequence that links the origin to the present day a bunch of different ways. And I don't know, I'm not even sure whose idea it was, but we worked and worked. And then someone was just like, why don't we just do it? People want it. We want to hear the song. How are we going to get the song in the movie? People want it. How are we going to do it? And we'll just do it where they're kids, and then they run in one door as kids and run out as adults. And that will tell that part of the story. And we're like, okay, this is perfect. But it's late, and the models aren't built, and these sets aren't built. And how are we going to do it? And to be honest, we were like on the other side of our budget, you know, like there's production reasons. But we all had a meeting, and we all like looked each other in the eye, and we're like, let's just do it. Let's go for it. And we did. And we had like, even Gabe Hilfer, our music supervisor, were like, who is going to do the song? And he's like, who do you like? Do you like anyone? Like, who do you think? And we're like, we wanted that kind of SoCal vibe going. Yeah. And I'm like, what about Best Coast? And he's like, yeah, let's give him a call. And then I looked and I was like, they're going on tour today. He's like, let's call right now. And they did it. Like, I think they did the song within like 3-4 days of talking to them. So it was awesome. And they were they were cool. And I love the way it's a good encapsulation of the movie. It's the same, it's the same, but different.
Yeah, I agree. It is the same. And it isn't one of those remakes that's trying to be different, It's actually a remake that feels like it fits within that animated sequence that they've created for this movie. So I like that as well.
It is pretty much a shot by shot recreation. There's we changed a couple of shots, but it is a shot by shot recreation of
You're using the season two, one of the shots season two, season one.
Yeah.
I noticed that as well.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. Like, this guy knows what he's talking about.
I know. You know, we're like, how are we going to do this? We can't show Shaggy in a bathtub. We can't fit. We don't have time. And I'm like, in season two, he was in a garbage can. So it's like,
put him in there.
We have garbage cans. The same garbage can from the alley behind the bowling alley. Let's
use it. Put it in there. you speak about the music of all Junkie XL was involved in this as well. Like, what was it like working with him? So obviously I, you know, he's done stuff outside of movies, then came in, did the, I think Batman v Superman stuff for Snyder. And now what was it like working with him on this project?
It was a collaboration and a relationship that is possibly one of my favorite things about this movie was that I got to meet this guy and now I do this with him, because I personally struggled. I had stuff in my head and I struggled with it. Like, they were like, what's it sound like? Like, you know, like usually you make temp scores, you know, along the way in the process, which are really just cut up versions of scores from other movies. But there, I was like, there is no movie. And then I even tried doing it with songs rather than, you know, and I'm like, this isn't working either. I can't express what I think this should sound like. And then I met Tom Holkenborg. We sat down and within 5 minutes I could tell what's going on in his head is what's going on in my head. And we were off to the races, and he's great. Yeah. He's great. He challenged me in great creative ways. And I that went back and forth. And I really love the score of the movie. In fact, it sounds so much like what I always thought it was going to sound like that when we were presenting it, when people started listening to it, they were like, this is a very original score. It doesn't sound the way I thought it was going to, you know, like, And I'm like, no, this is the way it always sounded. It's just you could hear it. Only Tom could hear it. But it's, I really love the music in the movie.
Yeah. The songs you choose, I've been doing this long enough that when I see a movie use like a song that's already been out, for example, California Love, I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, how much did they spend on this? And then you've got all these other songs in here. Were they Warner Brothers licensed songs or connected songs? Or did you have to pay to use all those songs?
We did.
Wow, that must've been something in the pitch to use.
It was. And people were very cool about that,
you met Tupac and you're like, hey man, is it okay?
No, but that was always the song to me. Right. Things come and go. Over the course of 5 years. And I was like,
yeah,
that is the L.A. anthem. I want this, we need to start in L.A. What is the most L.A. song? And we tried other things. And I was like, are you going to tell me this is good? And no one could say it. We tried. And for a while we thought we couldn't afford it and all that kind of stuff. But I was like, this is the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's like two or three songs where I was like, this is the song, the DJ Khaled song, the All I Do Is Win.
All I Do Is Win. Yeah.
This is the song. This is Brian's song. This is it. There is no other song.
Right.
We tried other things and I'm like, nope, this is Brian Falcon.
And it so works because Brian wants to say that kind of stuff up. It totally works.
I go to a lot of LA sporting events and I was paying really particular attention to what are the most iconic songs played at LA sports arenas. And both of those songs, you're going to hear three times every game you go to, no matter what the sport is, you're going to hear those songs.
Right.
So I thought they were good picks.
Was there a song you really wanted to use that in the end, you guys just couldn't do it or couldn't get the rights for it? Did every song you really wanted to use, you got?
Every song I really wanted, I got. One example was when Henry Winkler, his character is Keith, when he's announcing Blue Falcon and it begins like the Blue Falcon pre-show.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, that's got to be that Alan Parsons project that the Bulls played for every game.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, sure. And then we're like, hey, that ain't cheap. And I'm
like, we tried now that's topical again. Yeah.
We tried other things too. And I'm like, man, ain't right. There's only like, that doesn't work. Yeah. And especially, like I said, I grew up outside Chicago. So, and was the animation director of Space Jam. So,
right.
That is in my blood.
Don't underplay that. That's a big deal. That film still endures. I mean, I was going to ask you about it. I got two more questions, but I do want to ask you about that. Let me circle back to that. How much input did the actors have in the crafting of their character? I know we talked about Will Forte, but like Gina Rodriguez with Velma and Daphne with Amanda Seyfried and Fred with Zach. How much of their homework were they doing to come into the booth? Because I'll be honest with you, I have some friends who show run. And sometimes celebrities get involved and they don't want to do the work. They just want to come in, do their thing and run out. And there are stories about that. But there are other celebrities who understand they're servicing the piece and want to work with the director. Do you get that from everybody involved in the cast?
Everybody in the cast. Mm. Well, I mean, one thing is we're making a Scooby-Doo movie. So it's not like, if anything, so we didn't have like unfamiliarity where, everyone was familiar. If anything, we got a little bit of, I don't know, like that character is so iconic. But then it became like, no, we're not imitating. And don't be intimidated by the people who came before. Like, work it. Right. And we did everyone. But Ken Jeong working on Dynamite, that's a lot of back and forth, a lot of collaboration. And Jason Isaacs.
Yeah, it's Dastardly.
Jason Isaacs is Dastardly. Like, I love the original Dick Dastardly. Mm-hmm. But he's a pretty one-note, mustache-twirling villain. Not a lot of depth. But then talking to Jason, who's a guy who's made a career of playing bad guys a lot, But really the world's most interesting bet. Like, how do we make Dastardly interesting? Mm-hmm. And a lot of back and forth, a lot of talking and a lot of rewriting. Adam Zekiel, one of our executive producers, a lot of a lot of thinking and talking and rewriting and, you know, Dastardly and Muttley are like the shadow version of Scooby and Shaggy, right?
Yeah.
They both have this bond, but one is all about, you know, personal sacrifice. And while one is all about, I'll sacrifice all of you for, you know, like a personal sacrifice versus let me put you on the block for this.
Yeah, it's like it's sweet introverts versus crazy extroverts. That's what it feels like when you
juxtapose those. Yeah, they're both two dudes who love their dogs.
Yeah, you know, it's so true. And Dastardly in a very weird way, but yeah, I mean. Yeah. I don't want to give anything away, but that story he tells about his dog leaving through the port. I mean, that story was brilliant compared to what actually was happening. I thought that was hilarious.
One of the editors started doing like we at one point there. Well, I know we're kind of spoiler territory now, but at one point that was just straight. You know, like I'm telling the story and so I'm showing. Mirrored.
Okay.
Yeah, but then he kind of started messing with it. We were like, wow, that's a brilliant idea.
Totally works.
I was like, let's do that. That's Dastardly.
Yeah, of course. He's Dastardly. There is a lot of Easter eggs in this thing. As I was watching it, I was like catching them left and right, really enjoying it. And I love the Casey Kasem shout out. You know, I mean, the original voice of Shaggy, having him be the Casey's place where you're hanging out at that restaurant and whatever. Like, how much of that did you have to hold yourself back from doing? Because, I mean, you're not unfamiliar with the Scooby-Doo universe. You've done other things in the Scooby-Doo universe. So
the whole crew from every department and every capacity would chip in with Easter eggs. So, and I don't think we held back at all. I think we've got way too. If any movie has too many Easter eggs, it might be this one. Because I don't want them to be distracting, but it's sometimes like there are so many happening at once that I hope it's not distracting on the first viewing. But it wasn't funny. Oh, good.
Yeah.
But my favorite of the Easter eggs are the ones that are about the people of Hanna-Barbera, the creators, the actors, the people who created this property and who were part of that Hanna-Barbera family, which I was very lucky to be close to for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like that's personal, you know? So those are the ones I really like the most. Like you said, Casey's Creations, like, I grew up with Casey as Shaggy in America's Top 40. And then, you know, and then I start working at Warner Brothers and all of a sudden Casey Kasem's around, you know, like, so he's both Shaggy and a real man, a real human being to me. Right. So those, there's a lot of personal things in this movie. So
I think it comes through, Tony. I mean, you're the director of this thing. It feels like a love letter to this, to this franchise, to this property, to these characters, but a love letter that is not like, oh, you know, I forget about it. It's inventive. It's new. It's interesting. It's fun. It's playful. It's a love letter understanding what made the core of this work and endure for what, 6 decades now or coming on 6 decades now and doing it in a new and inventive way. I thought that was what came through over and over again is there's a lot of love here when you're watching the movie and that settles you down. When, as I said, you walk in with a little skepticism, wondering if it's going to be that good, and it settles you down. You go, oh, no, I'm in good hands. I'm good. I'm good to let go and just enjoy myself. And
as a fan, you should be skeptical, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a fan. You own it, right? Fans are the most skeptical people in the world. You
really are. We're the worst. We're just like this.
But that's good, and I appreciate you saying that, like, because we are also fans.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So we can argue about what we like or you know what I mean, but this is coming. This movie is made for families and fans. It really is, like, and fans who have families. So, and I hope that I hope we succeeded.
Well, I think you absolutely succeeded. And I think it's perfect timing. I know the coronavirus stuff and the COVID stuff, you know, delays everything and you make adjustments. And this would have been fantastic to appreciate on a large screen and not the vibrancy and the technology now that in some theaters are just incredible to watch movies in. But I also think this movie is great to go to video on demand now because families need this entertainment. Families need this kind of like distraction and connection. And telling you the lesson again of friendship, telling you the lesson again of family, you know, because in essence, the Mr. Machine crew is a family. So, yeah.
There is something about Scooby-Doo that I can't explain. I can't explain, but it is the number one. And this, you know, like we have research data. Yeah. It's the number one thing that parents want to share with their kids and watch together.
Wow.
And I don't know why. And, but it is comfort food. Mm-hmm. Like this is a comfort. This is a comfort. I've done a lot of Make-A-Wish, Scooby-Doo Make-A-Wish things. And you're like, you got one wish on Earth and it has something to do with Scooby-Doo. That's important.
That's awesome.
So, and a few of them, you know, like, so I agree with you. This is a tough time and people, it's tough and we're scared and we're insecure and things are uncertain and people are losing their jobs like crazy. And but if you could take a 90-minute break and sit down and laugh and see something colorful and fun and summery, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe it is good. You know,
I think so. And I think it crosses the political spectrum. So you don't have to worry about that. You can just sit back no matter what state you live in and enjoy it. You know, I think that's really important too.
Yeah, no, we're not taking a big, you know, like, I feel like there's, it's a cool thing that I think mm-hmm. everyone can enjoy and really across all kinds of barriers or whatever, like it's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the multicultural approach. I mean, I mentioned it a few minutes ago. I love Gina Rodriguez coming in. That's one of the gifts of voiceover is it doesn't matter what color you are. It matters what your voice sounds like.
It matters to me. I mean, it really does. It matters to me. Like we started talking to people really early on in the process, like in the first year, even though we knew we wouldn't record people for a long time.
Right, right.
And that's when I met Gina for the first time. And Gina is smart. Mm-hmm. And so Gina was like, this character is important. This character is a role model. Yeah. And I want to be that role model. Like, and she had all the right, first of all, she is, there's not a lot of difference between Velma and Gina. Like they're both, you know, like she kind of is Velma. That's brilliant. She's brilliant and funny and sharp, you know, and like.
And a little dark, like Velma is in the movie. Dark
and a little quick on her feet, you know, like so quick on her feet. Like, so that, you know, she meant it too. Like she's the first person to say it years later. We said, are you ready? I'm ready.
Yeah.
So, but being a little more diverse was really important. And we talked a lot about that. I'm like, these shows were all made in the 70s when everyone in the world was white, you know, like we need to diversify a little bit. And that stuff's important. We ought to be right. It's gotta be modern. So.
Yeah. And Tony, the other thing, you don't put a highlight on it. Like there's one moment where she says something in Spanish and you're just like, Oh, that's awesome. That's great. It's just subtle, just there. It's not a big deal. It is what it is. You move on. And I love that. I mean, as a Latino, like I said, I love that. It doesn't have to be highlighted, you know? It's just there for that moment if you catch it. And I
think cool. Thank you. Awesome. It was something we were aware. I mean, we were aware to try to do the right thing. You know what I mean?
So. Right. I know we got to wrap up. So can I ask you one last question about the Space Jam stuff? The Last Dance is happening. Is this a week? Like you're a Chicago, were you a Chicago Bulls fan growing up with Jordan and everything?
It was such a big part of my life.
Wow.
A huge part of my life. And then pre-Space Jam.
Right.
And then throw Space Jam on top of that. So I'll be honest, I haven't watched it. I've been recording it.
Oh, you're going to do it all at once, aren't you?
It's so emotional to me that I'm like, you know what I mean? Like all Chicago sports fans are emotional, but that is such a part of my life now that is a long time ago and all that stuff. And I feel like I need to watch it, but I need to like be ready because I have a feeling I'm going to need like 8 boxes of Kleenex to get through that documentary.
Elson's going to come in. You know what? No, I'm not dealing with this.
Sports fans are emotional.
We are. Damn right we are. It's we covered on. I do a sports show on this channel as well. We've been covering every two episodes, reviewing it. It's fantastic. So you're in for a treat for sure. Right. There's about 15 minutes in one of the episodes. It's all about Space Jam and the basketball games they were playing that they built him
in a the court. Jordan,
right?
Yeah, I was in those. I was there.
What?
You were
watching these basketball games? Yes.
Yeah, I could not believe the things I was seeing. And as a basketball fan, and you know, we got a lot of celebrities in this movie, you know, big stars.
Yeah.
And I think I'm pretty comfortable around people. Mm-hmm. I was never super comfortable around Michael Jordan, right? Because I was like, in my head, I'm like, he's Michael Jordan. The man's barely human. Right. You know, like, and one day, and I'm sorry, I won't go on too long. But
no,
one day,
go on as much as you like. I love this.
Like one day I was telling someone else this story recently. We were shooting, there was like one day of retakes, and it was after Michael had come back and the season was going. And I was talking to him about how the season was going, and he was telling me how he hoped it would go and what he was looking at. And I think we got a chance here and there. And maybe if this works out. And I was like, I cannot believe I'm having this conversation with this guy.
Wow.
And I still, I just can't believe it. Like, when Dennis Rodman came on the Bulls, we were shooting the movie and I was talking to him about that. And I'm like, this is history. Like, for me, it's the most important stuff in the world. So
right.
I got cartoons and Chicago sports are the only things that keep me going. So.
I don't want to tell you what to do with
I'm wearing a Dodgers hat because I like the Dodgers.
Oh, I get it. I've got two of those. I'm from DC, but you got to adapt. I get it. Trust me. Well, Tony, I can't tell you how great this was to spend time with you, getting to know you, meeting you, and talking about this project because I loved it. And if you are watching us right now or listening to us on the podcast network, please download this, order it, watch it, share it with your family. Scoob is fantastic, and it is something that brings you right back to the original series and does it in a new, inventive, and unique way that adults and kids we'll both enjoy and get something really good out of. And it could spark nice conversations between you and your children that could help them, you know, like cement friendships or repair friendships or relationships. And I think it's positive overall.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
This was a ton of fun. Thanks again.
I appreciate it. All right, Tony, I'm gonna let you go and finish out the show. Thank you so much. You can follow Tony at Tony Cervone there on Instagram and Twitter. Do you do Twitter as well?
I'm actually only on Instagram right now.
Oh. Well, why not? Yeah, is there anything else you want to plug or say?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay.
new things will come though. So.
Yeah, I like. Yeah, hopefully there's a sequel. I'm looking forward to a sequel.
We'll see how it goes.
Let's make it happen. Thanks, Tony. Take care of yourself, man.
Be well. Bye-bye.
All right, that was Tony Cervone stopping by for about 50 minutes to talk to you about Scoob. He's such you can tell already, such a fantastic ball of energy, great light, a lot of fun. Really enjoyed speaking with him now about it. And yeah, once again, it is out now. Video on demand, Scoob. Go and rent this thing. Go and watch this thing. Share it with your family. Have a great time doing that. And, you know, let me know what you think. Let me know what you think. I'll probably record a review of it as well, reiterating some of my points that you hear now on the show. And let me know if you enjoyed the episode as well. Remember to subscribe to the Outlaw Nation right there below. Hit that subscribe button. Get us marching towards 15,000 subscribers, marching towards 20,000 subscribers. Also, follow me at The Roka Says on Twitter. And Twitter and on Instagram. There you go. Follow me there on Twitter and on Instagram as well. And of course, be part of the Patreon. There's a lot going on here with the Patreon right there in the corner there. There's a lot of tiers that we've got set up, some new shows that we announced recently that you can be a part of as well. So go and be a part of that as well. Patreon.com/JohnRokaSays. Go and get involved. John Roka, patreon.com. John Roka there, and go and get involved there and see all the multiple tiers. All right, that's it for me. Enough of the jibber jabber. Go enjoy Scoob, and we'll talk to you next time on another brand new episode of The Deep Cut. Take care, stay safe. Until then.